All this week, we're reporting on email. Today, email and the law. One incriminating message can spell a big loss for a company involved in a lawsuit. On the other hand, a company that can't produce a key email in court could be even worse off. What's a business to do? NPR's Ari Shapiro reports.
If you're thinking about enrolling in law school, listen up. Ken Withers is director of judicial education at a legal think tank called the Sedona Conference.
Today, a young person graduating from law school and joining a large firm in one of our major cities can look forward to perhaps 3 or 4 years of doing nothing but sitting in front of a computer screen reviewing email and other electronic documents for litigation.
This is the modern legal landscape, where by some estimates, more than 90% of the cost of a lawsuit can come from sifting through emails and other electronic documents. Withers says in the old days, maybe 20 years ago, a case that involved 300,000 pieces of paper was considered huge.
That's considered a drop in the bucket today. The equivalent of 30 million or 300 million pieces of paper, if these were printed out, would not be unusual.
That may seem daunting, but it does carry an advantage. Electronic documents are much more searchable than paper documents. In fact, some companies now have proactive filters that can catch troublesome emails before anybody files a lawsuit. Cindy Launchbaugh is with ARMA International, a nonprofit association that deals with records management.
For instance, in the financial industry, one example might be the word guarantee. You know, guarantee a return of something. They're not going to put the company on the line for something like that because it can't uphold it. And it could come back and bite them later, obviously.
So if the word guarantee pops up in a company email, someone might check to make sure employees aren't promising something that they can't deliver. But many companies aren't that organized. ARMA co-sponsored a study last year that found 1 in 4 American companies does not have a system for organizing electronic documents. That system might tell companies what they keep, what they get rid of, and how to archive things if they need to go back and find a document in a lawsuit. But if a business without a system gets sued, it can cost a fortune.
It can get into the millions.
Dave McDermott is a records manager for J.R. Simplot, an agribusiness company based in Idaho that does have a records management policy. Simplot created that policy because 40 years ago, federal investigators came asking for documents.
And we didn't manage our information. Our records were stored in horse barns.
McDermott suspects many companies only get on the electronic records management bandwagon after they've been sued once. Today, a massive company the size of Simplot may juggle 300 or 400 court cases at a time. Each case requires its own set of documents that has to be retrieved and sorted. The industry calls it production. When a company that does not manage its email gets sued, McDermott says,
many cases are settled because the cost of production outweighs the cost of settling.
In other words, when a company has to choose between spending millions of dollars on sorting email and spending a few hundred thousand to settle a case, they may just pay the plaintiff to make the lawsuit go away. After that, the company's next step may well be to establish a comprehensive electronic document management policy. Ari Shapiro, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Alyssa Block. Time was when New York City was a place where artists could, well, live like artists. Rents were cheap and neighbors tolerant. Those days are long gone, but a recent study of aging visual artists in New York shows they are living happily on an average income of $30,000 a year. NPR's Margot Adler went to find out how they do it.
It was as if I had entered a very zen place. The artists I talked to ranged from their late 70s to their mid-80s. All seemed to need little outside of some food, a place over their head, and their art. I visited Hank Vergona, who was 78, in his tiny studio at the edge of Union Square. His paintings and drawings are on the wall, stacked in rows. He opened several drawers.
Now these are filled with drawings that I've done.
Ah.
These are all new.
Vergona has had more than 30 one-man shows. His drawings of satirical public figures have been published worldwide. But last year, he only made $17,000 from his art. He's averaged $25,000 to $30,000 a year. His studio has fabulous light, but it's only 300 square feet. His first studio in 1960 rented for $35 a month.
I don't want to tell you what it is now.
You got to tell me what it is now.
Well, it's $1,635.70.
That's a lot.
That's a lot of money, yes. And next year, they already told us it's going to be another 20%.
Can you afford to stay?
Well, this is my life.
If he has to, he says, he'll get an even smaller studio in the building. Vergona lives with his brother in Queens in a two-family house that was bought for $16,000 many, many years ago. He cooks for himself. He says he manages to spend about $30 a week on food and nothing on entertainment.
The last movie I saw was Fahrenheit 9/11. Before that, it was Shakespeare in Love. What is that, 15 years ago? Maybe more than that, you know? The last vacation was 1980.
But when you talk to Vergona, his is a world where money has very little meaning.
No one has ever heard me say, well, listen, would you like to buy this? I never do that. I talk about art. I talk about my love for it. I talk about, like, what you can get from it, you know? That a walk down a quiet street, especially towards, like, dusk, is as good as going to Caracas or Venezuela or anywhere. You know what I mean? It's nourishing. That's what art, that's part of its purpose.
And you feel he means it. Joan Jeffrey is the director of the Research Center for Arts and Culture at Teachers College, Columbia University. The center interviewed 213 visual artists between the ages of 62 and 97 about their life, their work, and their income. Jeffrey says 44% live in rent-controlled housing. Most of the rest, the majority, own their own homes or apartments. That's one reason they can live on so little. Jeffrey says for most of them, being an artist is an identity that transcends everything else.
They don't ever think of giving up being artists. They simply, if they get arthritis, change their art form, and that they don't retire. So there are lessons here.
What I saw in the artists I interviewed, their health may not be perfect, they don't have lots of money, but they are often joyous about life.
You don't stop. And there's no depression if you don't stop.
Pat Dillard lives in a third-floor walk-up. She does woodblocks and illustration. Her small apartment rents for about $700 a month. Her income is $29,000 a year. Despite being 81, she supplements Social Security by caring for people's pets.
Mostly cats now.
And what do you get paid for taking care of them?
You get $10, which is good.
Yeah.
You can make like $50 on the weekend, and that's good.
As for living cheaply, she says, buy stuff at the 99-cent store.
Sometimes I make chili for the week. It only gets better. If you want to have a pizza, you don't tip, you go pick it up.
And she has more advice on being happy.
The first thing I come out of the building, I look at the sky, white clouds and a blue sky. Oh, my heart goes pitter-pat.
Hank Vergona says something similar. Seeing the light fall on something and then perhaps you can get part of that into a piece of work, that's miraculous.
To feel that you're part of what it really means, you're part of the light.
You might think getting older with relatively little money in a city so focused on wealth and consumption would create bitterness and depression. Joan Jeffrey says these artists show how lifetime engagement and passion is a model for health and well-being. Margot Adler, NPR News, New York.
If you want to read the full study on aging artists, you can find a link at our website, npr.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne, and we're not working from home, but many people are these days. The reason is soaring gas prices. NPR's Frank Langfitt reports on the adjustments some people are trying to make.
Riz Khalik didn't like his commute to begin with. Some days, he spent 2 hours inching along in his minivan to an office in suburban Washington, D.C.
Even if I left at 5 in the morning, sometimes there would be congestion.
But when gas prices spiked a few months ago, that drive became even harder to justify.
The cost has just gone astronomical. You're talking about nearly doubling. Now it's close to $65 to $70 to fill a minivan.
So Khalik asked his boss at IBM if he could work from home 5 days a week. Now he works barefoot from his study in Northern Virginia.
I wonder, Eli, when we hear...
With Bloomberg's financial news to keep him company, he talks to colleagues around the globe.
Handy, are you there?
Going over marketing strategies. With instant messaging and a phone, Khalik says he doesn't need to commute or work a conventional day.
As long as I get what I need to get done, they really couldn't care if I'm doing it 2 in the morning or 2 in the afternoon.
IBM has been at the forefront of telecommuting for years, but other employers are now making similar changes to help workers cope with fuel costs. A survey by the staffing firm Challenger, Gray, and Christmas found nearly one quarter of employers are offering a condensed work week to reduce commuting costs. Local governments in Oakland County, Michigan, and Birmingham, Alabama, are letting some workers trade the traditional 5-day week for 4 days at 10 hours each. Linda Branch does payroll for an oil equipment company in East Texas. She wants that kind of deal. Recently, she asked her boss,
"What do you think about going to a four-day work week?" I said, "Because the price of gas is killing me, and that way that will save me 80 to 100 miles that one day."
Branch says starting pay for a job like hers is as little as 10 bucks an hour. So at $4 a gallon, gas takes a huge toll.
With the economy the way it is and food prices going up, it's either like, do you get gas or do you eat?
Branch says her boss likes the idea of a four-day work week. She's waiting to hear back. Cindy Williams lives in Florida and owns a company that handles environmental insurance claims. She thought about a four-day work week and decided against it. Williams says her company's work is so complicated, it's hard to do it for more than 8 hours at a stretch.
The longer the day goes, we think that people tend to start wandering around a little bit. You know, they don't seem as focused on what they're doing. And a lot of the claims that they're working on are technical and require a lot of thinking to complete them.
Instead, Williams will allow employees to telecommute at least one day a week. She has no choice.
I actually have had other employees that say they're going to start looking closer to home, and I can't afford to lose them.
Robert Half International, a staffing firm, found in a recent survey that nearly one-third of workers were looking for a new job closer to home. That's what Paula Luft did. Luft is an accountant and temp worker who lives outside Chicago. When she considered a new job recently, the commute was crucial.
One job they wanted to send me, I think, was like 35 or 40 miles.
She rejected it because of the fuel costs.
Not only are you commuting for an hour, you're paying one of your hour wages is going to the gas. To me, that would be ridiculous.
Luft looked at other jobs. She finally took the one closest to home. And in the age of killer gas prices, she's found the ultimate solution. She rides her bike to work.
I love it. I think it's wonderful. You know, I'm old. I remember when gas was 30 cents a gallon. We used to dig in our purse at the bottom for pennies to put gas in our cars. That's when pennies meant something.
Not anymore. Now, she'd have to dig for more than 400 pennies to buy a gallon of gas. Frank Langfitt, NPR News.
Now, you might think there's no connection between the Chicago Cubs and a tale from the Middle Ages, but it makes sense to commentator Frank DeFord.
In medieval Europe, when people were interested in turning lead into gold, there was a tale that maintained that this was a really easy thing to accomplish, piece of cake. Just throughout the alchemy process, you could never once think of the word hippopotamus. Obviously, once you heard that condition, the would-be alchemist could think only of hippopotamus, and thus it was that nobody ever turned lead into gold. I believe the same thing holds true with the Chicago Cubs, who have not won a World Series for exactly a century since 1908. The Cubbies would be a breeze to win this year if nobody ever mentioned 1908. Unfortunately, try it. It's impossible. Too bad. The Cubs, who have not won since 1908, have the best record in baseball. Now that the Boston Red Sox are losers no more, the Cubbies, who have not won since 1908, are the favorite of all the downtrodden dreamers in America. Bob Brenly, the Cubs announcer, says that should the Cubbies win for the first time since 1908, they will name a lake after Lou Piniella, the current Cubs manager. Cubbies win for the first time since 1908, they will rename Lake Michigan after Sweet Lou. I can see Rand McNally laying them out now. Lake Ontario, Lake Erie, Lake Huron, Lake Superior, Lake Piniella. And indeed, Piniella is just the right man to manage the Cubs to their first championship since 1908. The manager the last time the Cubs won, that would be in 1908, was Frank Chance, who owned the most envious nickname of any manager, the Peerless Leader. Wow! Piniella has the same sort of reputation. When he was a member of the 1970s Yankee teams, he and Catfish Hunter were recognized as the two guys who were accepted in all factions of a team that was called the Bronx Zoo. And Lord, is Piniella cagey. Despite a very distinguished career, the best play he ever made was a fly ball he didn't catch. Yes, isn't that just perfect for the Cubbies, who haven't won since 1908? It was in the 1978 playoff with the Red Sox, and when Pinella, in right field for the Yankees, completely lost the fly ball in the slanting autumn sun, he had the presence of mind to pretend that he had it all the way. The fly dropped about 5 feet away, but the ruse held the Red Sox runner and saved the game and won the pennant for the Yankees. Pinella can famously lose it when he's mad at umpires, but at the core he's cool and shrewd. Although he's a big, strong man, he never tried for home runs because that meant striking out too much, and he realized he didn't have the temperament for that. Home runs, Sweet Lou says, are the most wonderful instant gratification there is. Instead of the long ball, though, he went for the long haul, which is certainly the right man to have at the helm when you haven't won the World Series since 1908.
Frank DeFord with us for the long haul. He joins us each Wednesday from member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. There's expected to be a highly unusual outbreak of bipartisanship in Washington today. If all goes well, it will result in a major piece of civil rights legislation. Two groups that have been at odds, people with disabilities and American businesses, have put aside their differences to design a bill that now seems on an improbable fast track through Congress, as NPR's Joseph Shapiro reports.
Earlier this year, Kerry McClure told a congressional committee how he got hired to be an electrician at a General Motors plant in Texas. He explained how he quit the job he did have.
Sold my house, packed my bags, relocated my family from Georgia to Texas for the dream job I'd been trying to get my whole professional life.
But when McClure got to Texas, a company doctor discovered that he couldn't raise his arms above his shoulders, the result of a kind of muscular dystrophy he'd had since he was a teen. That disability hadn't stopped him from working as an electrician for more than 20 years. He simply used the ladder to reach high places. So when GM revoked the job offer, saying he was too disabled, McClure sued. Then GM argued in court that McClure wasn't disabled enough to sue using the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Well, you can't have it both ways. Am I disabled or not? If I am, then the ADA should have been there to protect me.
But the courts agreed with GM and ruled against McClure. Judges pointed to a series of Supreme Court decisions that have limited who gets counted as disabled.
It makes no sense for a person with muscular dystrophy to be told by a court that they're not disabled enough to be protected by the ADA. And if you went to any member of Congress who voted for the ADA in 1990 and you asked them, does this law protect people with muscular dystrophy? Every one of them would say yes.
Andy Imperato runs the American Association of People with Disabilities. He and other advocates felt court rulings had made the employment protections of the Disability Civil Rights Law almost meaningless, especially to people with diabetes, epilepsy, cancer, and mental illness. Last year, a court even ruled that a man with mental retardation was not considered disabled under the law. So advocates for people with disabilities have talked about rewriting the civil rights law, even at the risk of giving opponents a chance to weaken it further. Last year, a version of a bill quickly got support from more than half the House of Representatives that forced the business community to negotiate.
On occasion, public policy works.
That's Mike Aiken with the Society for Human Resource Management. He was one of the key negotiators for business.
Many of us here in Washington, you know, it's much easier to be on the defensive and just say no to everything, and sometimes it's very difficult to reach compromise.
He says employers want to hire qualified workers with disabilities, and businesses benefit when the law is clearly defined. The disability side gave up parts of its original proposal and agreed to a definition of disability that's a little more narrow than some disabled people wanted. But the result is that this morning, two House committees will mark up the ADA Restoration Act. It's the version endorsed by the disability and business communities, two groups that had often been at bitter odds. Kurt Decker heads the National Disability Rights Network, a group of public attorneys.
It has been truly an interesting experience to go on the Hill to meet with members and staff in conjunction with the business community. Most members care both about the disability community and protecting small business. So when you can offer them a response that seems to balance both of those constituencies, they really utter a collective sigh of relief.
That's why the bill is on a fast track through the House and possibly the Senate.
If all goes smoothly, it will get to President Bush by July 26th. That's the 18th anniversary of the original ADA, which was signed into law by a key supporter, President George H.W. Bush. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News, Washington.
Back now with Day to Day. In Washington, an exhibition at the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History provides hypnotic insights into the expeditions of a Harvard professor who wandered through the Amazon decades ago.
Right now, our colleague Alex Chadwick is away. He's currently wandering in Africa, but he left us this. It's the latest in his series about photography called Photo Op.
I've seen this place. I've heard it, too. The vast and mysterious forest, the old earth. The Amazon, life untamed. Birds, enormous insects, plants grown past anything I've seen before. This is where Richard Evans Schultes went exploring back in the early 40s. He was a Harvard botanist sent by the government that could no longer get rubber from trees in Southeast Asia, rubber that was needed for the war. He wound up helping to build the field of ethnobotany, studying how remote tribal people learned the medicinal and hallucinogenic properties of the flowers and vines that grew everywhere. He sampled many of them. And he photographed them. And the people who used them, big, soft-focused images in blacks and whites and grays. A Smithsonian botanist who helped create a new exhibit, John Kress, studied under Professor Schultes after he returned to teaching.
There's a number of hallucinogenic snuffs that the native people of the Amazon basin and other places take. They use various barks and woods and carve them into powders and mix them with various kinds of things and flowers and fruits. And then, much like we would snuff tobacco or tobacco is snuff, they blow this into each other's noses and gives a very hallucinogenic and a very rich experience.
And this is the source of shamanism and insight into explaining how the world works and the magic of the world?
I think so. Think of being a native person in the Amazon 100 years ago. I mean, your universe was the plants and animals around you as well as the other people in your village. Everything was attributed to those plants and animals. And the shamans were there to help heal the local people, but also, I think, to give them some spiritual guidance as well.
What about the photographs that we see here? Why do these pictures even exist?
Schultes was a botanist, but he also was an adventurer and in many ways an artist, and he took this camera along with him, a Rolleiflex camera, 4x5 negatives, high quality. He always took the photos on a tripod. He was there to not only document the plant life, but the culture that was in the Amazon at that point. And this exhibit is really about Schultes the person, the botanist, Schultes the photographer, and the cultures and plants of the Amazon basin as they were a half century ago.
Botanist John Kress. His co-creator, Chris Murray, runs a well-known Washington gallery, the Govinda, which specializes in photography. Professor Schultes, Chris says, made photos for scientific purposes, but he must have known they also went well beyond that.
The extraordinary thing about Schultes' photos is that he's primarily a scientist, yet here he brought into the Amazon jungle a Rolleiflex camera, and with that camera, he was able to capture photographs that had the criteria of fine art photography. The compositions were beautiful. When he was photographing landscapes, he would choose dramatic, spectacular subjects. His photographs of peoples were sensitive and intimate. He has the qualities of a great artist.
Let me ask you about a particular photograph here. This is a photograph of three boys in a dugout canoe. They're out on a river, and the dominant figure is standing in the canoe, and he's got a bow with a very, very long arrow.
One of the things that strikes me about Schulte's photos, including this one of these three young Amazonian natives, is that it speaks to the sense of wonder. And also, when one is a growing up and a young person and they're out for it with great adventures, there's a sense of venture in this photo. Here are these young boys with clearly very lethal bow and arrows and canoeing in their homemade canoe. It looks like something as a kid we used to do. We used to go into the rivers and lakes and get in a canoe and maybe make a make-believe bow and arrow. And here are these kids who are doing it for real. And so this particular photo evokes that sense of wonder and that sense of adventure that I think we all felt growing up as children. And here these children are indeed actually doing what we in our imaginations and fantasies were making believe we could do.
But there's something else here, and that is that these boys are almost naked. They have a little string and a tiny cloth covering their genitals, but it's also like the figure of David. I mean, it's as a piece of art. It's just...
There's an exquisite beauty in these pictures of these youth from this area and from this period. And it's actually the thing that first drew me to these pictures that made me realize that a wider public would be fascinated to see them. In fact, there's one of the three boys standing by a waterfall, which is the photo I saw. I said to myself, Bruce Weber, the great photographer in New York who does the Ralph Lauren campaigns and Calvin Klein, I thought of so many famous photographers who, if they saw this material, they'd say, that's amazing, because actually there's a sensual quality, almost a sexiness to some of the images here in terms of the wonderful natural surrounding and the energy of the water pouring over that waterfall and the boys just casually standing there in their habitat, completely native and natural. I saw this photo and I said, Bruce Weber, Calvin Klein, I said, if they saw this photo, they wouldn't believe it, how great it is and how beautiful and sensual it is.
Chris Murray, one of the curators of an exhibit of photos by the botanist Richard Evans Schultes. It's at the Smithsonian's Museum of Natural History in Washington. The exhibit and a book of images are called The Lost Amazon, and we have some of those images at our website, npr.org. For Day to Day, I'm Alex Chadwick.